Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Don't read the comments has become an age-old adage of the internet. Many comment sections can be pretty nasty, full of vile racist statements and personal insults. Popular Science recently dismantled their comment section entirely, citing evidence that, quote, uncivil comments not only polarize readers, but often change a participant's interpretation of the news story itself, end quote. YouTube recently announced that it will be revamping its comment section, and Huffington Post users can no longer create anonymous accounts. Comment sections were born out of a desire to foster communication and relationships between writers and readers. Ideally, they're supposed to be one of open exchange and dialogue, but in many places online, the comment section has degenerated into polarizing opinions and hate speech. The social web has become as much about harassment, shaming, and trolling as it has about sharing, connection, and cooperation. So how are websites attempting to regulate their comment section? A lot of people believe that they should be allowed to say whatever they want online. Some have opted for voting and rating systems, which they're hoping will bring the best comments to the forefront of the discussion. Where do you really draw the line between moderation and censorship? And what is the value of comment sections? Today, we are joined by Jillian York. She's a writer and free speech activist, currently serving as the director for international freedom of expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And she joins us from her office in San Francisco. Hi, Jillian. Welcome to the show. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, great to have you. And we're joined by Saraya Shamali. She writes about gender in media, politics, religion, and pop culture. Her work appears in the Huffington Post, Alternet, The Guardian, and other publications. And she joins us from Washington. Hi, Saraya. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Dietram Scheufele. He's a professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His most recent research examines the role of social media and other emerging modes of communication. And he joins us from Madison. Hi, Dietram.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Great to have you. So why don't we start off on a positive note before we get into the ugly comments and talk about the value of online comment sections when the comments are really good. Dietram, why don't we start off with you?
Sure. I mean, I think it's really important to keep in mind that in all of this discussion that we're having about cutting back on online comments, moderating them and so on, that talk in general is a good thing. And disagreement is actually a good thing. A lot of research in social science tells us that people disagreeing with one another makes them feel more efficacious. They feel better about their role in politics and science and other fields. It makes them more knowledgeable and ultimately makes them more participatory. So one way or the other, disagreement is a good thing, but it depends on how that disagreement plays out, how civil, how polite it is.
And what would you say, Jillian, when the comments are really good, what is the value of these areas on news and information sites?
Well, I absolutely agree with what was just said, but you know, I also think the sort of the entertainment value is another thing to add to that. I mean, I really do enjoy watching. I mean, I know I think snark has kind of taken over the internet sometimes, but I really do enjoy seeing the sort of the general public's take on an issue when it's a bit different from the journalists or the bloggers. You know, and a lot of times that includes humor, and I think that's great.
And Saraya, what would you add to that?
I think that. For the most part, because comment sections grew organically, there wasn't, I don't think, as much awareness of how valuable they would be in terms of actual content, right? So that on any platform, the comments evolved and have become a source of community and engagement. And those are all positive things.
Because you believe that the comment section can often be as important as the story itself.
Well, yes. I think that a lot of platforms initially thought, well, we're going to produce content and then some people will comment on it and that'll be kind of interesting. But I think it's almost it's a false assumption to say that the comments themselves do not become content and in many ways extend themselves to become part of a brand because of the way that they affect the culture of a site.
Can you give us examples of a few of your favorite comment sections?
Oh, my goodness. That's a hard one. My favorite comment sections. I will be honest. I try not to read too many comments in a lot of the material that I read and write. mainly because I'm in the don't read the comments school of thought. I always like reading the comments on Jezebel. I like reading the comments on The Onion. I would say I'm looking for humor, Jillian just said. I actually want to find the humor in the comment sections as opposed to abuse. And I don't really go to comment sections to find substance that often.
What about you, Jillian? Do you find substance?
Occasionally. I mean, actually, you know, I'm an admitted Gawker reader. I know that's a controversial statement sometimes, but, you know, I actually really like that comment section because I find that there are two interesting things that happen. I mean, one is the humor, and sometimes, you know, that's just some of the best stuff. The other, though, is the way that they have a downvoting system that sort of blacks out certain comments that are considered either distasteful or unhelpful, often kind of engenders a certain debate. And, you know, you often do see people calling other people out on racism or other things in the comment section of those articles. And I really enjoy that. I enjoy the way that format kind of engenders discussion.
What about you, Dietram?
I would tend to agree that Gawker is definitely one of the more interesting sites and a really good illustration of a lot of the things we've just heard, meaning a shift toward comments as entertainment almost, but also a site that I think has in a very interesting fashion learned to turn comments into original content, which I think is really a shift. And we need to keep in mind that in many ways what we're doing is still a transition away from the perfectly moderated and restricted comments that we have in traditional media. We always had letters to the editor, but 99% of those never made it to print, and even those who did make it to print were severely edited by professional journalists. So what we have now is, in many ways, from a democratic perspective, a much more open, much more interesting, and much more exciting environment, but also one that we're just beginning to understand.
Well, so what are your thoughts about how websites are dealing with comment sections? Because I really like the New York Times, for example. They separate the comment sections into three parts. There's just the original comments, and then there are readers' choices, readers' picks, and then the New York Times picks. So it's interesting, real interesting as a journalist to see what the New York Times deems as most interesting and then what the readers deem most interesting. Dietram, I mean, I like that model. What other models are you seeing out there?
Sure. I think in many ways what we're seeing is I think Sarai mentioned this earlier, the idea that media organizations look at comments as a way of building their brand. And the New York Times, of course, having a very specific readership, also looking for a very particular type of comment and structure in their comment. I mean, if you look at the Economist, for instance, you see a much more restrictive model, again, that reflects their very high SES, high socioeconomic status readership and the image that they're trying to convey. And then you have on the other end probably, you know, websites like if that's the UK Daily Mail or somebody else who is really trying to drive traffic. And, of course, controversial comments in many ways can drive traffic. And that's, from a commercial and an advertising perspective, actually a good thing, or at least an effective thing.
And are we seeing a rise in the number of comments left and the number of hostile interactions in comment sections? Jillian, do you know? Or Dietram, do you want to take that first?
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in.
No,
there.
No, it's fine.
I apologize.
Go ahead.
In our research, we really haven't seen necessarily an increase in incivility, but we're definitely seeing more incivility on sites or in forums that allow anonymity than we do, for instance, in forums that don't. And I think there's just another study that came out that showed something very similar, meaning more incivility and more non-polite exchanges in forums that allow anonymity than on Facebook, for instance, which is, I think, what their comparison group was.
Well, and it's interesting to look at popular science, because I bet a lot of people wouldn't expect a lot of incivility on the popular science website. And they dismantled their section, citing evidence that uncivil comments polarize readers and change a participant's interpretation of the news story itself. They went so far as to say that this could compromise research and available funding if unfavorable policy were to follow disgruntled public understanding. So they thought, let's get rid of it altogether. What were your thoughts on that when that announcement came down? Jillian, what were your thoughts?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that on the question of anonymity, I mean, I really think that, you know, the data just isn't there. We don't have the evidence to back up some of the claims that are being said about that. And, you know, so I think that I do agree with the, you know, the previous comment there.
Well, what about, would you call that censorship because they're getting rid of the comments altogether?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that that's on the particular sites that we're talking about. I mean, I think that it's a tricky question. Is it censorship to not have a comment section? I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think that people have been calling it that on social media because, you know, they previously had one. But there are plenty of news sites out there that don't have comment sections. And I think that that's an okay choice.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something about the use of that term? Jillian's going to laugh at me. The whole idea, though, of censorship, there's the difference between, you know, the First Amendment and the popular notions of speech and censorship. And so none of these companies is the government, right? They're not censoring anybody. They have their normative interpretations of what they want to appear on their sites, and those interpretations are illustrated in the way they manage their comment sections, right? So some are more restrictive, some don't exist, some are totally open-ended. However, they don't have an obligation. I mean, they're private companies, right? And so they are constantly regulating speech, which goes back to, I think, your question about the way the New York Times does it, which I think is very interesting, because I don't think about the way speech is manifested as a reflection of our social structure, but it really is kind of a reflection of our social structure. And so when a company like the New York Times is making those decisions, it's making those decisions, as Ditrin said, as part of the brand that they want or the content that they feel is relevant. And they're making those decisions because of the community that they have and the readers that they have. And so I think that the way in which these sites are choosing to do it is super interesting if you consider the nature of the structures that they're choosing to support when they do it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I do agree with Soraya here. I mean, I think, you know, I feel the need to clarify since she said I would laugh, but I'm not laughing at this one. I think that where I draw the line is when companies that sort of purport to serve as neutral speech platforms and that use the language of free speech. And so I'm talking about Facebook and Google Plus and Twitter, the social media platforms. That's where I draw the line, because I think that those are companies that have, you know, in many cases over a billion users, and they interfere in private, or not private, but sort of semi-private or friend-based discussions. And that's, I think, a different line than when you're talking about a news site. I think, you know, when we're talking about news sites, I think they, you know, just like I sometimes moderate comments on my own blog, I think that that's an absolutely legitimate choice. I don't think it's always the best choice, but it's certainly a legitimate choice.
And that is Jillian York. She's a writer and free speech activist serving as Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're also joined by Ditrin Scheufele, professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Soraya Shamali writes about gender and media, politics, religion, and pop culture for The Huffington Post, Alternet, The Guardian, and other publications. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about comment sections on online news and information sites. Popular Science recently got rid of their comment section altogether. YouTube says it's going to revamp its comment section. And Huffington Post recently decided to not allow users to create anonymous accounts. So you have to have a name connected to your account. And so what is the value of online comment sections? What are the sections you like to read? Do you leave comments? Do you spend a lot of time reading them? In many cases, they can be as interesting as the news site is or the story is. So what are your thoughts on that? And what are some of your favorite sections? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And where do you draw the line between moderation and censorship? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, what kind of impression do you get of your fellow citizens when you go on some of these comment sections? What are your? Can you talk more about that, Jillian, just about the line between censorship and moderation?
Sure. I mean, sorry, I don't think it's a totally clear line. And again, I mean, I certainly am not going to disagree with the definition of censorship, which does come from governments. But I think what I'm saying here is that some of the social media platforms that we engage in on a daily basis have kind of inserted themselves into the public space, the public sphere. And so they're private companies, but they act like the public sphere. And so they're essentially the quasi-public sphere. I think that, you know, those companies often create terms of service or rules and regulations regulations that censor our speech, even on our own sort of semi-private Facebook walls. And that's what I've got an issue with. Sometimes, you know, I want to go on a rant that's full of profanity, and Facebook blocks me from doing that. If I'm, you know, keeping that amongst my friend circle, I don't think that that's really a legitimate action. On the other hand, you know, if the New York Times wants to make that rule as a newspaper, I do think that that is a totally legitimate action, because you've got a ton of other places that you can go, whereas Facebook is, you know, nearing monopoly status.
Well, we've got a question from Mark in San Francisco. And Jillian, this might be good for you, because I was wondering when someone was going to bring up the San Francisco Chronicle websites, the comment section there. And Mark writes, the comment section must be among the worst or the worst in the country. In a San Francisco publication, the comments are overwhelmingly and bizarrely vile, racist, sexist, anti-poor, warmongering, right-wing, and the list goes on and on. Any article that even borders on supporting some type of social justice issue gets these comments. Why is this? Who are these people? What is the benefit of this? Jillian, do you read the comment sections on SF Gate?
Well, so I just opened it to click, and I mean, on the one hand, he's absolutely right. That's what I'm seeing here on the first article that I clicked on. But on the other hand, you know, it's weird because they do keep their comment section fairly hidden. You have to click a couple of additional things to even open it up, and it's kind of hidden in this, you know, size 10 font view comments, and you know, you have to register to comment. And so I'm not sure that that's a really emblematic example of comment sections in general, but it is sort of strange that that's what a San Francisco newspaper would end up garnering for comments.
Yeah, Dietram, what are your thoughts? The comment section on the SF Gate is pretty nasty.
I think what we've heard in the last 5 minutes or so, I think there are a whole bunch of very important distinctions here as far as public, very public platforms like Facebook and so on that really see themselves as platforms that allow the public to engage in an almost unrestricted discourse with one another in different subgroups and so on, and then news sites. And we were actually the study that the Popular Science referenced when they shut down their comment section. And I think Popular Science is at the other end of that scale, meaning it's a very specific type of content, scientific. So we're not talking about, you know, social welfare programs or something that was just mentioned, but we're talking about scientific facts. Hmm. And those being reinterpreted by readers simply by how loudly and how mean they are to one, how loud and how mean they are to one another. So in other words, what we found in our experiments is that the more people started yelling and started hurling insults at one another, the more likely they were to actually reinterpret the scientific facts that they had just read about in Popular Science. So Popular Science, I think, agonized long and hard about this and eventually shut it down. That's very different from what we see in politics, or not very different, but it's certainly a different quality from what we see in politics, where a lot of opinions, where a lot of issues are really more about opinions than they're about facts. So should we have particular programs are, in many cases, a question of ideologies or of what we believe government should or should not do. Those are issues of ideology and so on. And that's where I think the vile comments, that's where the anger very often comes out more. And again, that's not necessarily always a bad thing, as long as we follow some basic rules of deliberation. American politics has a long, long, long history of people yelling at each other, including politicians. And the idea that it's better now than it used to be is probably not true. In fact, if you look at history, 100 years ago or so, we were probably much more partisan and much more name-calling than we are now. So it's certainly not a new phenomenon. It's just one that I think right now is highly visible.
Well, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because it is easy to look at the dialogue and just to see what's going on with government and to kind of forget about history and that this is nothing new.
Exactly, and we've had a partisan press in the past. We've had, if you look at some of the speeches, political speeches that were given, even just 100 or 150 years ago, 120 years ago, those were all not necessarily people being nice to one another. In fact, those were very aggressive and in many ways, you know, going in ad hominem attacks. So something that's very similar
about what you just said, because I don't know if you have any research that's specific to the context, though, that you're referring to. Sorry, it's Soraya. I'm just wondering if the amplification that occurs because of the nature of the internet makes a difference. Mm. And also, it seems to me that the quality of the language, which you've referred to before, makes a difference. So that if the language in comments is abusive and intrinsically racist or misogynistic, It creates a denigrating environment, right? I mean, that's got to be part of the equation. So whereas in popular science, the studies that were done showed that it had a corrosive effect on the actual science that was being discussed, don't you think there are parallels to be drawn that indicate that there is a corrosive effect, a harmful effect on certain constituencies if the commenting community is really, really vitriolic and hateful?
I would very much agree. And I think we're actually, in many ways, that public discussion that we're having right now surrounding comments has thrown together a lot of different things into one big pot. I think we're talking about different levels of civility. We're not just talking about ad hominem attacks, we're talking about racism.
Yeah.
Or are we just talking about, you know, somebody calling somebody else an idiot because they disagree with them, or maybe, you know, yelling a little bit too loudly and so on. So I think we're having that. I think we're having the amplification effect, which you have mentioned, meaning we have a whole new way of messages spreading and reaching large numbers of people very, very quickly, no longer controlled through mass media in the very sense, meaning one medium reaching a lot of people. So I think there's a lot of different factors that need to be delineated, and depending on what they are, I think produce very different outcomes. And we're just beginning from a research perspective. I think it's really the burden is on social science and academics and to really begin to research that and give us answers on what will happen if we engage in certain types of discourse, what will it do to our political system, what will that do to voters, to citizens, and what are the outcomes that we as a society want to have of that Web 2.0 discourse. So I very much agree.
Well, thank you for writing in, Mark. And if you're still listening, I'd love to know how you think the SF Chronicle should deal with these comments, or should they just let them continue as is? So you can give us another email if you have thoughts on that. And before we go to break, let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken.
Hey, good morning. I was actually calling on something else, but I am a frequent SF Gate commenter, and a lot of it can be about the content of the paper itself and their placement of celebrity garbage about the Kardashians or daily real estate ads on their main page masquerading as news stories might be a comment I make. Yes, it is rough and ready, and yes, you will get a lot of conservative issues or flames if, like somebody mentions, rent control in San Francisco. But also realize that it's used by PR firms to load the comments. I mean, this was done, you know, your San Francisco issues, when they had a big to-do about choosing a vendor for Stowe Lake and Golden Gate Park. The Rec Park Department, a city department, actually had hired a PR firm headed by Alex Turk, the Newsom's former right-hand man, and they were loading the section and actually even loading community meetings with planted people that they would call on who would act like toadies and say, yes, it's a great idea to have these changes and increase the offerings of this snack bar. So that was publicly manipulated. It's being done today with the Warriors Stadium because their group is spending $150,000 a month on PR.
So, Ken, we have to go to break in a couple seconds.
So,
but
other than that, though, I find the tech sites to be more helpful with reader content. I think reader content should be open, and I'm very dismayed that sites require people to use Facebook to log in. That is a tracking issue and should be stopped.
Well, thank you for calling in. And that's a good question, because I'm seeing more and more of that you have to use your Facebook account.
Even on NPR.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. All right, we'll check that out. We'll talk about that right after a break.
There are many ways you take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone, via email, or on our website, yourcallradio.org. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can go to the website, feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the costs of solar power. The market is changing. The costs are coming down. There's a lot of government programs. So we're going to talk about what this means for solar. How will increased access to solar change our energy landscape? That's tomorrow. Today, we are talking about online comment sections. They have evolved a lot over the years. And when they're good, they can be really good. They can actually provide a lot more information sometimes than the news article. But when they're bad, they can be pretty ugly. Popular Science recently dismantled their comment section altogether. YouTube is changing their section. Huffington Post says you can no longer be anonymous. So what are your thoughts on this? Where do you draw the line between some moderation, censorship? For example, if you go to the Chronicle's website and you don't like the comment section, do you think the Chronicle should do something about it? Or maybe allow users to vote on the best and the worst comments, so make it like a two-tiered system. What are some of your favorites? And then what is the value of comments? Sections. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our comment section, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Dietram Scheufele, professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jillian York is a writer and free speech activist. She serves as director for international freedom of expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Soraya Shamali writes about gender in media, politics, religion, and pop culture. Check out the piece she wrote earlier this year for the Huffington Post, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes. It's called The Digital Safety Gap and the Online Harassment of Women. This is also a major, major issue, the intent to silence women online. But before we do that, I wanted you to comment on Ken's question. I just checked out NPR's site, and it looks like you have to sign in to use... Right. You have to sign in to comment, or you can sign in with Twitter or Facebook. So, Soraya, what do you think are the consequences, or what could the consequences be of having to use Facebook, for example, to comment? That means your real name and your account is directly tied to your comment.
Right. I think that actually that begs a much, much larger question of privacy, data mining, data security. I think that people are just only now realizing something honestly, that's been going on for more than 30 years, which is the massive collection of data about our private lives and our preferences and our propensities to do certain things. It's just much more obvious in this networked environment that we all are immersed in that this is happening, and that it's happening in exponential ways. I personally think that having to sign in using a service like Facebook is inhibitory. Like, I won't do it half of the time, for example, just anecdotally, because I figure the only person that's responsible ultimately for the privacy of my data is going to be me, because nobody else really cares. But, yeah, I think that's a problem. I think that people don't want to have to use services and if they don't want to, and they certainly don't want to necessarily have all of these identities merged and cross-pollinating, which is, I think, legitimate.
Yeah, and I'm seeing more and more of this. In fact, when you like an article on, say, CNN, they'll give you a box and say, what do you like about it? And then that will be posted on your Facebook page. So it's all cross-connected.
Right, and I think what Google just did is important, too, because now if you review something, for example, a restaurant review in Zagat's, Google will now take your image and your review, and they can proliferate that as advertising anywhere that they want. And so, you know, it really, the terms and conditions that we all, you know, there are jokes about us signing away our lives every time we click a terms and conditions box, but they're actually not that funny.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Well, and Jillian, what are your thoughts on this? Because, you know, those of us who maybe didn't grow up with the internet are talking about these issues and privacy specifically, but teenagers and people in their early 20s probably have no, they don't even think about it. They probably connect a lot to their Facebook pages.
Sure. I mean, I think that, well, so the one thing that I would like to say there, though, is that, I mean, there is some really excellent research on how young people view privacy. I know, like, from Pew, as well as Dana Boyd has done a lot of great work on that. And so, you know, you'd be surprised at how much more they think about privacy than we do sometimes, or than we would think they do. But at the same time, you know, that doesn't always mean, you know, it's not always the same way that we think about privacy. And so I do think, you know, the Google Plus thing that was just mentioned took me by surprise a couple days ago. You can go in and shut that off, but that was something that, you know, I would never have even really thought of because I don't use the platform that much, but I do have a profile over there. And so, you know, I do worry that a lot of times, you know, we're being used for these for-profit purposes. And granted, I mean, I fully accept the notion that we are the products and as well as the customers, but at the same time, you know, I do see this becoming a little bit more exploitative from a lot of the social media platforms.
Well, we have a caller who wants to talk about Facebook and that and those connections. Let's hear from Drew in San Francisco. Hi, Drew.
Hi. I've heard you guys making comments about the necessity to use Facebook to log into so many of these sites, and I myself, oh my God, I was just as afraid and disliked it as much. I mean, when you see them tracking, you go, oh my God, what can I do? But I did find that, in fact, there are some things you can do. Number one is most of the sites allow you to sign up using DISCUS, this DISCUS, which is an independent account. The second thing is that you can install, particularly if you're using Firefox or Chrome as browsers, a plugin called Disconnect. And basically what it does is anytime a third-party site like Facebook or even Google or, say, for example, one of the advertising networks tries to connect your cookie to somewhere into their back system, they stop that connection. And so literally your only interaction with that site is what you're doing right then and there. No connections outside of it are being made other than the ones you interact with it. So there are ways to overcome this commenting problem with Facebook and things. Number one is use the site's own ability to set up an account to make a discussion point like I do with SF8 or others. There's number two, DISCUS, this kind of third-party commenting platform. And number three is make sure that they can't track you by installing things like Disconnect, which is a plugin for Chrome or Firefox. I think there's an equivalent for Explorer, but I'm not sure. And use those, and you'll make some progress.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. So we'll put a link to that Disconnect right after the show. And I just want to mention that we use Discuss on the yourcallradio.org page, but we also just allow you to leave a message without signing up. We wanted to make allow that because we thought that was important. We actually have a couple comments on our site. Carl says, why in the world would anyone want to leave a comment in the online comments section? Thank you, Carl. That was nice. Dietram, do you want to add anything about just what does your research tell you about where this is going in terms of just the personal information that you need to provide before you can leave a comment?
Sure. I think it's really important, and I agree with everything that has been said, and I very much agree that social logins and Facebook and Google Plus are not the only ones. This is obviously the holy grail of big data, the idea that a single login would allow marketers to connect everything we do online to our credit card accounts, to what we search, to what we look at online, and allow them to market to us in a micro-targeted way, meaning no longer as a demographic, but as an individual, where we really become the transparent consumer in many ways. But all of these things, of course, we're using because they also have their upsides, right? And I think Jillian already referred to this. We're the product, then we're the consumer. The reason that Google Plus and Facebook and our email and all these things are free is not by accident. We're running large server farms that use as much energy as any given city. Those cost a lot of money. And the reason they're free, you know, these services are free, is because we end up providing data for marketing. But the second advantage that we haven't talked about is neither NPR nor any other media organization, of course, uses this because they want to, you know, necessarily feed more data to Facebook or anybody else, but because they're hoping that the lack of anonymity, that the face that's provided with it, sometimes literally or at least in terms of a name, will lead to better discourse. And I think there's some truth to that. We know from social science for a long time that we have for hundreds and maybe thousands of years learned to interpret the nonverbals around us. If I say something and we're all sitting in the same room and I'm getting three raised eyebrows, I'm probably realized that I've said something that's inappropriate or over the line, even if I may not have realized it initially. Now, all of that is missing. All those nonverbals are missing online. And in the real world, I would never go to a funeral wearing a red suit, not because there's a law, not because it's outlawed, but because I probably have a fairly good idea in my head what will happen and how embarrassing it'll be, how I'm going to be ostracized, and what the social consequences are. And what we've built with this anonymous environment is we've built an environment where I can go, still go with that red suit to a funeral, but I'm wearing a ski mask. Nobody will know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the problem in many ways. And so the upside of using social logins or forcing people at the very least to reveal an identity that's meaningful is that the ski mask is off, and that we'll have to, at least a little bit more than normally, deal with the social consequences of our actions. And that's not a bad thing. That's actually what has governed, as I said, for hundreds or thousands of years, our interactions and made them more polite.
That's very based on where in the world you are, right? Because anonymity for historically oppressed groups online actually enables them, it frees their speech. Because otherwise, in many instances, they'll be penalized, right? So that assumption is fairly first worldish, right, in many ways. That may not be the right categorization, but there are places where communities need anonymity in order to be able to express themselves at all. Certainly from the perspective that I'm coming from, which is perspective of women who are, you know, engaged in movements that are counter to theocracies, for example, that anonymity is really essential.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're comparing apples and oranges here, though, in terms of two different problems. One is the problem of civility online and our people yelling at each other for no good reason. And I very much agree with you. And I think on the second one, and that is the power differentials, that in Web 2.0, we hopefully have much less. And I think that was exactly the discussion that some people had when Google Plus forced real names from the very beginning. Mm. And I think some people were concerned about the very thing, Sarai, that you just mentioned, and that is that takes away that power equalizer in many ways that anonymity can provide.
Right. I think it really depends on where you are when that's happening.
I agree.
And that is Dietram Scheufele, professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Saraya Shamali writes about gender and media, politics, religion, and pop culture for publications like The Huffington Post and The Guardian. And Gillian York is a writer and free speech activist serving as director for international freedom of expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. I'm getting a few emails about personal experiences, so if you'd like to share some of yours in the online comment section, we'd love to hear from you. What are some of your favorites? What's the value of these comment sections? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our site, yourcallradio.org. You do not have to register and you don't have to use your real name. And let's hear next from Peter in Oakland. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think it's a double-edged sword. I think that places online where there's anonymous commenting tend to be pretty vile. YouTube and even SFGate have some of the worst comments I've ever seen online. Whereas like New York Times, I find a lot of very valuable information from the comments. In fact, oftentimes even more valuable information than what was in the article itself. So, it's a double-edged sword. I don't want companies mining my personal data, but at the same time, I think not hiding behind this veil of anonymity brings a more cultured discussion online. Uh-huh. That's really all.
All right. Thanks for commenting. Dietram, your response?
I very much agree. I think that in many ways, you know, summarizes the dilemma that we just talked about, and there's not necessarily an easy answer yet.
And I'm just checking out the New York Times. I've never left a comment there, but you do have to create an account, and it looks like they just ask for your email address and a username, and they don't connect it to Facebook. So it's kind of interesting to look at who does and who doesn't. We've got an email from Damien, who believes that some of the extreme commentary on SFGate might be coming from outside of the Bay Area. And unfortunately, we'll never know because it's not connected to where you live. And then we also have a comment from Carol who says, I had a disturbing experience reading the comments on a San Diego Union-Telegram op-ed piece they published last week by innocent death row San Quentin prisoner Kevin Cooper. His op-ed was about the torture of death row prisoners and his own personal experience coming within less than 3 hours of having been executed. He was recently interviewed extensively, and it says she says the disturbing comments were bloodthirsty, hateful calls for quick execution for Kevin Cooper, whose powerful proof of innocence has been documented in a book called Scapegoat. She says the internet comments allow and even encourage the lack of civil discourse and worse for shock value. I'm against censorship, but we ought not to encourage such hateful speech. Dietram, has your research looked at how these comment sections actually affect people when the speech can go really far?
Sure. And the study that Popular Science actually referred to was an empirical comparison of different modes of communication. Now, we didn't go really toward hate speech, which obviously would raise a number of ethical issues as well in terms of exposing people in experimental settings to hate speech. But we did look at more and less civil, so name-calling or the lack thereof. And what we did in experimental settings, we gave people the exact same content, and then we exposed them to comments that were, from a content perspective, made the exact same argument. So people were exposed to the same facts or arguments that pro or against an issue. The only difference was the civility. And that's exactly what the finding was that Popular Science referred to, meaning the less civil things get, the more people start to reinterpret the facts. So in the case of a death penalty case, for instance, we could see, and certainly our research would suggest that, even though it was in a different issue, one could see that people start thinking about the perpetrator, about the issue of the death penalty, much different simply based on the tone of comments that they're exposed to. The ironic part, of course, is that if you look at the comments that followed the press releases and the news articles and even a piece in The Onion about our study, those comments were probably as vile as they get, calling us everything from communists to being paid by the government to not having real PhDs and so on. So in a very humorous way, they actually completely made the point of our study, and of course, in an unintentional way.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the email. And I wanted to talk to you, Soraya, about the piece you wrote, or all of you, actually. But you wrote a piece earlier this year called The Digital Safety Gap and the Online Harassment of Women. And I actually know a lot of women who don't really like to write, especially op-eds, because the attacks are so brutal. And you write in this piece that the first time you received an online threat was in response to an article in which you suggested the benefits of allowing boys to cross-gender empathize the way girls do. So can you talk about that? Like, what's been your personal experience with online attacks?
I think mine is probably fairly typical for a woman in the sort of public sphere, especially talking about feminism and gender. I get a fairly regular flow of threats, some of them very violent, some not. I've only had to go to the FBI really once. One in particular just struck me as of concern. But other than that, usually the language that people use is, you know, it's meant to demean, humiliate, reduce a person to their body parts. I mean, it's pretty standard kind of sexist objectification stuff. But there is no doubt that it affects women more, somewhere in the area of, I think, 75% of abusive content online is targeted at women, and that it silences them because many, many choose not to engage, right? They cede the ground, they leave the space, they stop writing about certain topics or in certain places. And honestly, it's happening online, but really it's a mirror image reflection of what happens on an actual street, right? And it's the digital version of street harassment in many ways.
Well, and just to let people know what women have to go through, I mean, you said you only had to call the FBI once. And in your piece, you write, quote, "I get threats that include being stalked and raped. Most recently, one man explained with his actual photograph and name in Facebook, quote, 'If you guys ever gain ground, we will take that ground back with guns. I will make sure there are roving squads in every community going from house to house looking for feminists to kill.'" I mean, how often is this? Because I've read about some horrible stories involving women.
That doesn't happen often to me. I know that it happens to other people, and you know, there's really no shortage of examples where women have been targeted by cyber mobs, right? That's a one-off thing. But in your area, Anita Sarkeesian, for example, and Adria Richards, and in England, Caroline Criado Perez and Mary Baird, and there are many, many people that have been the targets of kind of a mob assaulting them with rape threats or with death threats or other pretty ugly language, among other things. So I think it happens every day to some degree or another. Certainly we see it, for example, in YouTube recently when there was there's a lot of racism that's expressed, homophobia, sexism, it's all of a cloth. My research that I've seen just shows that it's extremely concentrated when it comes to women. And, of course, we kind of think, okay, there's, all the feminists are white and all the African Americans are men, but that's just not the way the world works, right? That's the name of a book that was written years ago, and it's true. Women are experiencing these assaults online, and they're experiencing them as women of color, as women who are lesbians, as women who are trans. It doesn't really matter. They are the primary focus for a lot of this aggression and hate.
And what is being done to deal with this?
Well, it kind of falls in a hole, right? Law enforcement really is not equipped to do anything with it. Our legal system is grappling with what to do about it. All these platforms are likewise. We engaged, I and Women Action, the media, and Everyday Sexism engaged in a confrontation of Facebook's policies in regard to this speech in May in a campaign called Facebook Hate, not because we were trying to get them to silence people, but to get them to understand that the criteria that they were evaluating content on was not fairly dealing with women in considerations of safety and threats and what harm it constitutes. And so I think that we're really just at the beginning of trying to sort out exactly what all of this means and how we deal with it. I mean, law enforcement offline doesn't particularly deal with harassment either, right?
Mm, right.
So moving online and assuming that our policies and practices would be any different, I think, is a pipe dream.
Dietram, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, just to echo what Sarai just said, I think we're really in a situation or in a transition, rather, where certainly in some areas, I very much agree with Sarai, that we have problems even with the offline version of law enforcement, for instance, not being able or not being equipped to deal with this particularly well. But in the online world, I think the problem that we're having is that we haven't reached a new state after, going from offline to online. But what we are really doing is we're going down the highway 100 miles an hour in a car that we need to change. We know we need to change. We may not need windshield wipers anymore. We may not need wheels anymore. But we need to make all those changes while we're driving, while there are bumps in the road, while we're crossing bridges and so on. And law enforcement doesn't know, or the legal system, for example, search and seizure, all these things, digital search and seizure, there's absolutely an underdevelopment as far as laws go. Same thing for these platforms that we started this discussion out with. But I think the burden is also on citizens to some degree, because citizens have in many ways not acquired the same literacy when it comes to these online environments as we have maybe for traditional media outlets or forms of communication. As I said, none of us would wear that red suit to a funeral that I mentioned earlier. And we haven't quite figured out yet how to deal with this in the offline setting. How do we not? What keeps us from sending those hateful notes? Those of us who do, or that very small group who does. And I think that's something that we just need to start negotiating and figuring out.
And Jillian, I mean, there are real consequences as a result of this. I mean, a lot of women are not sharing their ideas with the world because they don't want to deal with the potential outcome. And even, a lot of women who don't write regularly, the comments might not be that nasty, but they still are just uncomfortable with it. So how should that be dealt with?
No, it's absolutely true. And I certainly, by taking a stance that is opposed to censorship, do not by any stretch mean to diminish that fact. And I too have often experienced that phenomenon on social media. And so I can't say that I've found the right solution. I can't say that any of us have. But I think that I can speak more negatively about this in the sense that I think that censorship often it ends up being kind of a Band-Aid effect, where you're slapping a Band-Aid over what is really, I've written this before, but what is really kind of a giant festering societal wound, and something that I think we need to be looking at not in terms of the speech, but in terms of the underlying causes. I've challenged folks to convince me that censorship is the right action, and I I'm open-minded to that idea, but I don't think that it will solve the societal problem.
I think there's a real tension between highlighting what's going on and saying, you know, this is happening, and confronting norms with the objective of challenging the ones that exist and changing them so that you actually free more speech, right? We don't really think about it in the negative. We don't think of the coercive effects of denigrating humor or violent abusive speech and on silencing people. Balancing all of that with not censoring them is very hard.
And Dietram, final thoughts from you, about a minute left.
I think the term norms is a really important one, because I think we're lacking them in the online environment in many ways, the norms of interacting with one another, of establishing the same norms that we've had in town hall meetings, where nobody would tell somebody that they would send a, you know, come with guns after them if they did certain things. I think those norms, establishing them in the online setting, will be absolutely crucial.
Well, these days they're bringing their guns to the town hall meeting.
That's not funny, but it is.
It is not funny at all, but it really is happening. Soraya, quick final thoughts from you about where you hope this goes in the future.
I personally really hope that in having conversations about the nature of public debate online, it will force us to confront, again, the norms that we assume exist offline. And so if we're talking about speech and we're talking about social power and the distribution of those things, I'm just hoping that all of these kinds of conversations enable us to broaden the conversation to include everything, as a matter of fact, not to stay narrowly in the realm of online space, because I think that they're just dimensions of the same things. And so I would like to see prejudicial norms confronted online and off when it comes to speech and social structures.
Soraya Shamali writes about gender in media, politics, religion, and pop culture for publications like The Huffington Post. Check out her piece, The Digital Safety Gap and the Online Harassment of Women, at our website. Dietram Scheufele is professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You can check out his research that was used by Popular Science when they shut down their comment section. And Jillian York is director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What do you want to know about the costs of solar power? On the next Your Call, we're talking about the impact the changing solar market is having on California's energy economy. The plummeting cost of solar has made it more accessible to families and those with low incomes. So what has changed to make solar so affordable? How will increased access change our energy landscape? And how are utility companies responding? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.